So I will do this in English so Mark knows what I tell you about him. So Mark Moldvin, he's a professor at the Michigan University. He is visiting our group at the University of Bergen called Birkeland Center for Space Science. He's been there since August, I think, on a Fulbright stipend as an Arctic chair, which is a prestigious thing. He has been, like a lot of Americans, they move all over America. So he's been in UCLA professor, he's been in Florida Tech as a professor, and before that he did a postdoc at Los Alamos. I think you will briefly mention that. He's also a member of ICAN, which is an international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. So I think that's should be okay.
Yeah, awesome.
And he will talk about consequences of nuclear war, and he promised to be very pronounced in his speaking so everyone will understand, right?
Yes, thank you very much, Nikolai. I always tell my students, never apologize before you give a talk, but I'm going to break that rule. For some reason, my computer and projector are not working, so I'm hoping all the slides come out clear. And hopefully my American accent is clear, but if not, feel free to interrupt. And I'm also going to be talking about nuclear war that involves physics and climate physics and space physics. And so if there's any terms that I use accidentally without clarifying, feel free to raise your hand. If anything I say gets you thinking about something that you have questions, feel free to interrupt. I'm going to try to have a discussion with you. If you don't ask me questions, I'm going to ask you questions to make sure that you're paying attention. But one of the things that motivated me to give this talk, a neighbor of mine when I was growing up is a professor of physics, Al Saperstein. And what's interesting is that he's been a mentor of mine for over 50 years, which seems strange since I'm only 54 years old. But he was our neighbor when I was very little. So he was the first physicist I've ever knew, the first professor I ever knew, and he was a neighbor. And he also won an award a few years ago given by a peace group similar to this for his work on trying to communicate the necessity for people like us to actually care about foreign policy, politics, and war, and be involved with our local communities as well as our national and international communities. And he won an award at a group called Plowshares, and the keynote speaker there was another physicist, and he said, all of us in the room, we're mostly physicists, need to communicate to our students and to our neighbors the concern about nuclear war, because after the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Berlin Wall, which I guess is 30 years ago now, this year, we've sort of forgot about the concerns of nuclear war, and not to push aside all the other crises that are going on in the world, from climate change to Brexit to Donald Trump. This is one of those issues that can change society and civilization overnight. And so I'm a professor of climate and space science and engineering at the University of Michigan, and here as a Arctic chair at the University of Bergen. And so one of the questions is, why should a professor of physics give a talk on nuclear war? And the research that I do primarily is in space weather, but there are a lot of climate impacts to nuclear war. And those are some of the things, from ozone destruction to nuclear winter, that gets most people's attention. We also live in a very interesting technical space age civilization. How many of you have a smartphone? So it's amazing how dependent we have become on technology. And when we get up in the morning and we turn on the light, we expect the light to turn on. But all of our technology, from the power grid to our communication, is susceptible to complete obliteration by nuclear war. And so even if you're not in ground zero, civilization for you will change. And so you can sort of think about what would life be in Bergen if there was no electricity for a month, for 6 months, for 6 years. And you can start thinking about how drastic a change that can happen. The other organization of physicists primarily is the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists that was founded after World War II. Since the US Manhattan Project that developed the first atomic bombs had hundreds if not thousands of physicists and engineers come together to build this fission bomb. Many of the scientists immediately had deep regret about what they contributed to. And so they thought about what they can do to help not put the genie back into the bottle, if you know that saying, but at least to try to prevent the use of nuclear weapons against humans ever again. And so the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists came about primarily from scientists to raise the issue of the importance for anti-war movements, for peace movements, for diplomacy. And they to communicate the severity to it, they developed a doomsday clock, and it has a minute hand that they move farther or closer to midnight. And if we ever strike midnight, that means we've had a nuclear war. And it has been moved just this year ago to 2 minutes to midnight. And that's the closest to doomsday we've been since 1953. Oh. If I dance. And in 1953 was the year that the Soviet Union tested their first fusion bomb. So we are, if you talk to people who study diplomacy, non-proliferation, and nuclear weapons treaties, we're the closest to nuclear war now in 2019 as we've been since 1953. And primarily it's because of Donald Trump pulling out of many international agreements, including those with the former Soviet Union, with Russia, and with Iran, and with NATO. So they're a good test of any lecturer is if I can give the talk without my slides, but we hope we won't have to do that.
I have one of these. Does this help you?
No, because this is only HDMI.
Yeah, okay.
So I think we're good. I'm not sure on what's going on. But the other reason I'm giving a talk is just it's all of our responsibility to communicate to our families, to our neighbors, to our colleagues, our ethical obligation for peace. And Sherry Rowland won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for his work in understanding the ozone hole and the ozone destruction. Molina and Rowland figured out the catalytic destruction of ozone due to chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, which were used in aerosol spray cans. And so they published that work, and both of them became very active in the environmental movement, recognizing that this man-made molecule that we used in a lot of industrial processes was contributing to the destruction of our ozone layer that had all types of ramifications on different ecosystems as well as human health. And he essentially became very active, and when people asked him, why have you become politically active in the environmental movement? You're a professor of chemistry. Shouldn't you be objective? And when you enter the political realm, you suddenly have to take a side. And he essentially said that as a scientist, it's not enough simply to publish a paper. It's your responsibility that if you believe you found something that can affect the environment, it's your responsibility to do something about it. So one of the lessons here, and I probably don't need to tell this crowd, is it's your responsibility to do something about it. And there are so many, from climate change to war and peace, what can you do individually? There's a lot of things that we can do. And part of it is just being active and engaged with your local and national, international politics. So this ethical obligation has a long history, from the Bulletin Atomic Scientist to ICANN to Union of Concerned Scientists. So I'm going to talk about the consequences of nuclear war, and essentially this slide was supposed to have a little step-by-step, so I'm going to show it all to you right now. But there's essentially three types of, if you're a war planner and you wanted to bomb somebody with a nuclear bomb, you have three options. You can have the bomb actually hit the surface of the ground, essentially a ground blast. You can have an air blast, so maybe 10, 20 kilometers above where you want to target it. And then the other one is you can have a high altitude detonation, over 100 kilometers above. And the physics of what happens to the upper atmosphere and the lower atmosphere are different, depending on where the bomb goes off. And so I'm going to go through each of these steps. And so an air burst is this thing 800 meters to 8 kilometers above a city. And the first thing that happens is that the blast causes the cities to burn. And one of the lessons of World War II was cities burn. So if you bomb a city, even with conventional bombs, the city will burn. From Dresden to Tokyo, we've learned that cities are made of flammable material. What's interesting, since post-World War II, cities are now made out of plastics. And so cities really burn now if you have a large enough fire. And so one of the things that happens is you get this cascade. Once the fire gets big enough, it gets hot enough, and essentially it will go out of control, continue to burn, put soot and aerosols into the atmosphere, a lot of smoke. That smoke is enough for a major urban area to essentially block out the sun. And so you change the radiative balance, or the amount of energy from the sun that reaches the surface. You can also have large, the stratosphere is the layer above the troposphere where we live. That's where the ozone layer is. And you can get large stratospheric temperature increases. You can have stratospheric warming, which changes the global circulation of our weather patterns. So once you get into that region, and it's very similar to a volcano. You have a volcano that has enough energy to launch dust and ash into the stratosphere, it can spread globally and have effects on temperature.
Excuse me, you yes. have to add radioactivity, right?
Yep, so so I'm gonna neglect the actual impact of the bomb. So it kills people through radiation. There's radioactive fallout. You can be burned. There's a huge pressure wave that will just knock down all the buildings and all that stuff. But I'm gonna focus on the global impacts. If you're at ground zero, it's almost good because it will be over quickly. The blast wave comes very, very quickly, and most of the immediate deaths, depending on the size of the bomb and if it's on the ground or in space, are very quick. You essentially get irradiated or burned or literally blasted, depending on how far away you are from the zone. But these effects are ones that have impacts globally, not necessarily only in local. And we'll talk about a global exchange. Once you get into the stratosphere, you can have chemistry going on, just like Roland and Molina discovered with CFCs. You can have the same type of catalytic ozone destruction. And so ozone is a big absorber of ultraviolet light. And so as you change the amount of ozone, you let in more UV, which can have detriments to the ecosystem below, humans and ocean biota. And so essentially, this chain all leads to devastation of global agriculture. You've essentially put smoke and soot into the atmosphere, and you decrease the amount of sunlight making it down. You essentially can lower the temperatures, and you have big impacts on ecosystems. And the term that was developed was nuclear winter. So if instead of blasting it at 800 meters to 8 kilometers or so, you actually have it hit the ground before it detonates, one of the differences is you make a big hole in the ground. So very World War II-y, is you throw a bomb, it's going to make a big crater. So it's like an asteroid impact from the killed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. You have a large amount of energy that can evacuate a huge amount of Earth. And that creates huge volumes of dust that could be uplifted and again block out the sunlight. So that sunlight is reflected. Little sunlight reaches the ground, and you can have big temperature drops. So both a ground burst and an air burst essentially leads to nuclear winter, which can have a big impact on agriculture and ecosystems and civilization.
I have a question about
yes.
the nuclear winter. As humans, we don't know the total consequences, but can we compare it with the 400 and something AD when there was this huge sort of volcanic outburst?
Yep.
And make those older stories about that, yeah. Those 2 years, the summer wasn't. Could
so
it be worse and kind of the same type of global
so there's
winter?
Been, there's been a number of events where climate has changed relatively quickly. Almost all of them were due to asteroid impacts or volcanic eruptions. Large amounts of energy, large amounts of dust and soot and aerosols into the atmosphere get into the stratosphere so they can spread globally. But volcanoes, even Pinatubo and Mount St. Helens, and I can't pronounce the name of the Icelandic volcano a few years ago that shut down air traffic in Europe, their effects generally drop the temperatures by a fraction of a degree for a year or so. And I'll show you some global climate simulation models and effects of a nuclear winter can last on the order of a decade in temperature drops of many tens of degrees instead of a fraction. So it's an order of magnitude. It's much more equivalent to an asteroid impact than it is to a volcano. The last big asteroid impact they're thinking was about 12,500 years ago at the end of the Pleistocene, and there was a big wipeout of megafauna, so the saber-toothed tigers and the mastodons, and people have been wondering what caused the end of these guys, and there's a lot of evidence now that it was an asteroid impact. And so you can sort of think about the same types of energies that are deposited by kilometer-sized rocks flying at tens of kilometers per second that hit the Earth are the same as what we can unleash as humans. We've developed the capabilities that are equivalent to the worst days on Earth. But for high altitude nuclear detonations, and this is one of the areas that Nikolai mentioned, my postdoc was at Los Alamos in the Nonproliferation and International Security Division, and part of their research was to do treaty verification against atmospheric and high altitude detonations, so make sure that the Soviets and I was a postdoc in the early 90s, and so the end of the Soviet Union was in 91, so all that stuff was still going on. And I'm also the principal investigator on a US Air Force satellite called DSX that's attempting to study natural radiation events that are very similar to a high-altitude nuclear detonation. But one of the things that a high-altitude nuclear detonation does to our technology is it releases what's called an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse. And an EMP comes in multiple flavors, but one of the things you can think about is a big electric field that can propagate away from the blast zone, and it can destroy power grids and anything with circuitry. So essentially, electronics can be damaged or destroyed. Much of our, since everybody has a smartphone, you have a GPS receiver. Have any of you gotten lost lately? Right, if somebody says, I'll meet you at your, you know, you just hit Google Maps and it gives you turn-by-turn directions, right? We don't even pay attention to where we're going. We just listen to our phone. We're completely dependent on satellites from getting our news, our weather, our navigation, all of our communication systems. And one of the things that high altitude nuclear detonation does, it creates a huge artificial radiation belt. So we have natural radiation belts called Van Allen radiation belts. But you can make a huge one much closer to the Earth, where most of the low Earth orbiting satellites are. And one of the things that we know by actually detonating bombs in space is the satellites get wiped out because of this intense radiation. So this, all of our space electronics, satellites, weather forecasting, et cetera, are impacted. So you have this rapid, very large scale, continental, if not global scale disruption of what really defines our modern technology, our satellites and power grids. An air burst is sort of in between again. It's similar to what I had said before. But one of the things getting to your in terms of radiation dose, ionizing radiation. Has everybody had an X-ray? Yeah. Broken arm, go to the dentist,
MRI. <Too many>.
And so X-rays are fantastic. I can look to see what's going on inside my body without cutting into it. Right? So they're very useful for medical diagnostics, but they're considered ionizing radiation, ultraviolet, X-rays, gamma rays, and charged particles. And it has enough energy that if it does interact with a cell in your body, it can damage the DNA or the cell itself. And so ionizing radiation is what gives us skin cancers and cataracts and all types of things that impact the cells. And one of the units of radiation dose is a REM, radiation equivalence in man. And the way we generally try to think about radiation is how much energy is deposited into the tissue. So the unit of radiation is the rad, energy per mass. So if you're a scientist, how many of you are physicist or radiation oncologist or anything like that? So, so a joule is a unit of energy and mass is a kilogram, right? So how many joules per kilogram? And that's a rad. And what's interesting about human bodies or living tissues is that our different cells, our skin cells, our muscle cells, our bone marrow, our DNA, our lungs, blood-forming organs, everything reacts differently to different types of radiation. Some are more sensitive to some types and some other types. And so it's very hard to generalize if I give you a certain amount of rad, what it would actually impact you. And so radiation physicists have developed this REM, radiation equivalent in man, that attempts to scale that amount of energy depending on if it's an X-ray or if it's an alpha or a beta particle, and what energy it is, and how it actually impacts health. So hopefully, none of you need to learn about this if you develop a cancer or have family with a cancer, but it's an unbelievable tool because we can deposit a large amount of energy in a very narrow place. So if you do have a brain tumor, you can go in and get radiation treatment where the radiation, most of the energy is deposited in the tumor. So it only destroys the tumor cells, but it's not perfect. Some of that radiation is gonna affect you in ways that you don't want to. And so some of the common side effects are nausea, because our biome, our gut bacteria, is very sensitive to radiation, so those often get killed. Other thing is you often lose your hair, is because our hair follicles are very sensitive to radiation. And so those are the two of the big symptoms of radiation sickness, nausea and hair loss. And so hopefully none of you have experienced those due to radiation treatment. But in today's days and age, almost all of us know somebody who has had some type of treatment. But the amount of radiation that comes in, and maybe I'll just turn around, also has, instead of space electronic system impacts, ground electronic and power system impacts. Do you know where Bergen gets its electricity? So when you turn on your light switch, where did that electricity come from? Is there some hydroelectric plant somewhere? But it comes along a long cable many kilometers from somewhere. And wherever you have long wires,
Malta.
Is it just up in the mountains just here, or is it farther away?
In the fjords, north.
So anywhere you have long wires, if I have a big electromagnetic pulse, I can put a huge potential drop on that power grid. And the system is designed to take the power that's being from the power plant to your transformer outside your building. And so I can essentially overload the power system. So one of the big impacts of an air burst is it essentially will wipe out the power grid, because it would damage all of the transformers. And so just like a high altitude nuclear detonation, it will have a big, large scale disruption of power and communication. And so the terminology that we often would use for HAND, high altitude nuclear detonation, and an air burst is that we'll enter Stone Age 2.0. Because essentially we'll knock out all the communication and power systems.
I'm sorry, I missed the part where you explained those two categories. What's the difference between?
So this is generally like a kilometer to tens of kilometers, and this is hundreds of kilometers.
Okay.
So this is in outer space, and this is in the atmosphere.
Okay.
It's an interesting detail. And so let me, this is supposed to be another one of these striptease things, where I...
It's really striptease. Yes.
Intriguing.
But essentially, I'm sorry, my technology. Somebody's radioactive. So,
Nick, what can we do?
It will work.
Yeah. Two cables. The one that was here was broken.
Okay.
I mean,
so I got two other ones. And
should we try another one?
Okay, I'm going to stay away. So this view graph essentially on the vertical axis, and let me delete that. Oops, delete the whole thing.
Yeah.
The vertical axis is the number of nuclear weapons in the world as a function of time since the Manhattan Project, and it divides it up between the US and Russia and the total arsenal. And you can see that after World War II, essentially the US was the only player. And so you had a huge amount of political and foreign policy clout. You were the only nuclear power in the world. And then part of the concern was when the Soviet Union also developed, and if you're familiar with all of the espionage and spies and all the tradecraft on how the Soviet Union was able to develop their fission bomb process.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Even Roosevelt was interested in it saw it as important, not only Truman after him, right?
That's right. I mean, so
this is interesting.
Yep.
I
so
think Roosevelt is being so fantastic and nice guy.
Yeah, so a lot of the early fundamental research that led to the development of the fission bomb grew out of sort of the modern physics era of understanding the nucleus of an atom. So Fermi in the 1930s developing all types of things. So it took a while, and to make a bomb was sort of the next step. But once you developed that in the 50s, the Cold War, it really took off. And we started to have tens of thousands of nuclear weapons on Earth. And one of the interesting aspects of the development of these weapons is that at some point early in when I was born, we had enough weapons to essentially hit every city of 25,000 or more. Right? I mean, you just had enough. You know, how many cities are there in the world? You know, tens of thousands of them. And so the foreign policy between the Soviet Union and the US during the Cold War was called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. If you attack me, I'll attack you, and we'll wipe each other out. So it's a suicide pact. I won't shoot if you don't shoot, because I know if I shoot, you'll shoot. Right? And so it started escalating. And you can sort of see this growth of how do I beat my opponent? I have a bigger nuclear arsenal. And so they just kept on going on. In the early 80s, many of the computer simulations for global climate were in their infancy, and people started to look at, if I dump this much energy into the atmosphere, what type of impact would it have? Would it be like a volcano? You know, it would have an aerosol, and it would have smoke, and it would have this stratospheric chemistry impacts. What would it do? And so Crutzen and Birx, 1982, are the first paper that published the term nuclear winter. They did a one-dimensional column model that showed that it had a huge impact, and temperatures would drop catastrophically. And then the number, and what's interesting, both in the United States and in the Soviet Union, started reproducing that data. And so people like Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev started to listen to their scientists, which seems so strange in today's age. And again, that, you know, that we know that natural events like volcanoes and asteroid impacts can cause global climate change. But now we know that a nuclear exchange, nuclear winter, can come about. And Mikhail Gorbachev also said that Russian and American scientists showed that nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that would be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. And so they got together and said, this mutually assured destruction thing doesn't make any sense. If you want to perpetuate humans, we need to start doing something about it. And so some of the first nuclear arms limitation treaties came about, because of scientists developing the data showing it's truly mutually assured, it's truly MAD to continue to do this. And so both the US and the Soviet Union essentially let a lot of their nuclear stockpiles decay away. Each nuclear warhead has a finite lifetime because of the trigger mechanism. And so if you don't actively replace it, it will essentially no longer work. And so they essentially stopped investing and building more new ones and let existing ones go down. And you can see that there were a few treaties that limited to more in 2018. We still have about 5,000 nuclear weapons on Earth, and these are the big ones. It's not zero. One of the interesting aspects of nuclear weapons, it's considered a weapon of mass destruction. It can cause global devastation. And every weapon of mass destruction, biological, chemical, landmines, all of those have been banned by international treaty. Nuclear weapons are the only weapon of mass destruction that has no treaty signature. And essentially, the permanent members of the UN Security Council are all members of the Nuclear Weapons Club. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of defines our international diplomacy right now, is who has the bomb and who are the pariahs in the view of the UN security are the Irans and Pakistans and North Koreas, people who are trying to get the bomb, right? And so this non-proliferation issue. What I deleted was essentially, under Obama, a new nuclear weapons program budget was developed to essentially maintain the, modernize the nuclear weapons so we continue to have the same. And the US spends about $1 trillion on the military, about $700 billion not fighting wars, and the other ones are fighting wars. And about 15%, 10-15% of that is for nuclear weapons. So $40 to $50 billion a year is spent maintaining a nuclear arsenal that we know if we ever use it, could end all life on Earth. So if you've been reading the paper lately, Gorbachev has been in the news. This is from 2018, but he also wrote an editorial just a month ago, I think in The Guardian, warning the world about nuclear weapons, because he sees what's going on with Putin and Trump essentially pulling out of weapons treaties and now testing them. The Russians just tested a new submarine ballistic missile just 3 weeks ago, right? So there's even tactical weapons that are being tested again, which essentially, in a military doctrine, says it's okay to use small-scale nuclear weapons, artillery shells and stuff like that. But we know that that's not true. So we're 2 minutes to midnight, right? So we're in a big issue. To try to put things into perspective of volcanoes and whatnot, today's arsenal is about a third of what it was in 1985, but it is still about 5 megatons. We have 5 megatons of nuclear weapons. If you add up all of the bombs deployed in World War II, it's estimated to be 2 to 3 megatons. And they estimate that if you add up all the bombs in world history, it was about 10 megatons. So we have 5,000 megatons. And so each one of us gets a few kilotons of TNT. So each of us get about a Hiroshima type of bomb. What would you do with your, if it was distributed to the 7.5 billion people on Earth, right? We have this unbelievable amount of destructive power. And what's really weird about the US system, there is one person who can launch a preemptive nuclear attack. And there are no safeguards. It's the President of the United States. He can order an attack. It's just really weird. And so unless there is a coup saying, no, I'm not going to do that, one person can destroy all of humanity. So this is Hiroshima many months after the bomb, the roads have been cleared. There was a 15 kiloton bomb, right? We have 5,000 megatons. So a megaton is 1,000 kilotons. Right, so many thousands of times bigger than this bomb. It immediately killed 150,000 people. And Hiroshima and Nagasaki were small cities, right? They were not the Tokyos or Berlins or Londons of the world. And so it essentially obliterated the city. It was made out of wood and paper, so it burned. And then almost all of our data on radiation effects, acute radiation effects, blasts, come from survivors in the suburbs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the firefighters and soldiers of Chernobyl. Right, those are essentially the only places where we had big blasts of radiation. So 15 kilotons can devastate a community. So what happened if we dropped the bomb, Fat Man, Little Boy, on Bergen? So here's a map of Bergen. Where do you live? So here's the downtown, here's Kronstadt.
I live there.
So each of these different colors represent blast zones, and essentially out to here is instant death, but you die different ways. If you're in close, you essentially get obliterated by the blast wave, you get obliterated by the radiation, you get burned, firestorms, and this is a blast wave, essentially like a bomb. And so out to here, essentially, concrete buildings get collapsed, right? So this big, huge overpressures. So this is the World War II atomic bomb. And there's technically a difference between an atomic bomb and a nuclear bomb. An atomic bomb is a fission bomb, where you break apart uranium and plutonium. And a fusion bomb is where you combine hydrogen into helium, or deuterium into helium. And it's the same process that powers
the sun.
Right? And so you can get huge amounts of energy. The trigger mechanism for a fusion bomb is essentially an atomic bomb. If you detonate an atomic bomb, and it causes the enough heat and energy that you can get fusion to go on. And then it has a self-sustaining detonation. So this is a small bomb. Estimated fatalities are essentially everybody here in the center of the city. The biggest bomb that humans have ever detonated on the surface of the Earth is a Russian Tsar. It's a 50 megaton. So instead of kiloton, 50 megaton. And now here's a map of Norway. Pulled out, dropping it over Bergen. This is the blast zone. So, and then you have to start worrying about all the radioactive fallout. And so this is the typical winds coming off the North Sea. And you can see that the fallout extends in the first hours of the blast, up essentially all the way to Oslo. Right? So depending on where you are, you can get a lot of fatalities. But a large fraction of everybody who lives in this area is wiped out. And again, we have 5,000 nuclear bombs, right? So we can, it would take us a long time to list 5,000 cities to even target. So what we know about the reaction of this globally is from a colleague, a former colleague of mine at UCLA, Richard Turco, and the last author, Carl Sagan, wrote a paper in 83 on nuclear winter. And essentially they did a climate simulation of, if I dumped a bomb and had this much smoke and soot and aerosols, what would happen? And so we're sort of doing an experiment. What would happen if we doubled the amount of CO2 in our atmosphere? Right? So we're doing that experiment now, right? So that's climate change. And we've run these models and we know what's gonna happen. They have melted ice sheets and all that stuff, right? Sea level rise. Ecosystem collapse. They did the same thing. But instead of over years and decades, these things happen instantly. You dump all this energy simultaneously. And essentially, this was a very simple model. And this was the result. It's essentially time after detonation in days, 100 to 200 days, and then temperature decrease in seas. And notice that the tick marks are 10 degrees C. So if you had a nuclear war in northern summer, where you had temperatures of 15 degrees C, immediately after, the temperatures would be below minus 20 C in northern summer. Essentially, you're gonna block out all the sunlight. And in this 1D simulation, this lasts for months. So essentially, you would have a year without a summer. And so if you think about what would be the impact on agriculture, if there is no summer in the Northern Hemisphere, when you think about refugee problems now because of drought. And this is global, right? So even if we just dumped it on Ukraine and Germany or the US or whatever, this would be a global impact. Since this is a 1D model, it missed a lot of physics. And so a number of papers in the next few years started to use the most advanced climate models, some of the first global three-dimensional models. And this one was just looking at the smoke injections. So if I just estimate how many teragrams of smoke are dumped into the atmosphere, and the data were from World War II, we firebombed Tokyo, and we could estimate how much smoke went up based on the amount of kilotons we dumped on the city. And this is kind of hard to see, but this is a global map. Here's North and South America, Europe and Africa, and Asia, the South Pole and the North Pole. And the thing to pay attention to is this T equals 0, 2 days, 10 days after the exchange. And the thing to look at is this, this is northern summer, this hashed area. That hashed area are below zero, so below freezing. And so northern summer, we have our normal nice sunny days in Bergen, lots of sunshine, suddenly no sunshine, and then within less than 2 weeks, pretty much all of Europe and North America are put into winter. So this was nuclear winter. So you can go from summertime temperatures to below freezing. And so more recently, colleagues, Alan Robach, who's at Rutgers University, and others have been running, even our more current models that have been running all of these climate change models that we've been doing, looking at, it's, instead of dumping all this gases into the atmosphere over years, decades, or centuries, what if you did it in an exchange? And you can estimate, you know, how many teragrams of smoke and blah, 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 and you can start looking at it. What would happen if we launched all of them? What happened if we had a limited, what if India and Pakistan just had a limited exchange? Not like India and Pakistan would ever get in a war, but they're both nuclear powered countries, and you can imagine 10 kilotons on Islamabad, 10 kilotons on Delhi, what would be the impact, right? So you can run all of these models. And this is the change in surface air temperature for June, July, August, so summertime. These are in degrees C. And you have for a bomb that on Kiev. Sorry, Kiev. But you have temperature drops within the first year of minus 30, minus 35 C. So from summertime temperatures, 15, 22, 25 C down to 35 C, you get a huge drop. And it's not just ground zero. This gets into the stratosphere. This becomes global. Sunlight and ozone destruction happens all over the place. And so even North America, minus 25, minus 30s temperature C in summertime. And so South America, Africa, right? So a year without a summer. Well, how long will this kick around? Just looking at Kiev, this is 3 years worth of data. The black is what the normal climate is. And you can see wintertime, summertime, wintertime, summertime, wintertime, summertime. The red is this climate simulation run for the 3 years. So essentially, here's zero C for the entire 3 year period, you're below freezing, even in summer. So instead of a year without a summer, you have 2 years without a summer, 3 years without a summer. And many of the simulations, depending on your, how many teragrams of smoke and all that stuff, it could be decades. What would happen to agriculture? Do you know how to grow your own food for 10 years with no sunlight, no electricity? And so this is why everyone should be concerned about nuclear weapons. It can be huge. Are you? Can you visualize Michael Mann's hockey stick diagram? Are you familiar with that term? Mm-hmm. So the hockey stick diagram looks at the last 1,000 years of data and then looks at the temperature in the last few decades. And sort of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, he had it as a plot and it goes way up off the scale, right? This is his hockey stick diagram. That way up off the scale is a fraction of a degree. And so nuclear winter are tens of degrees instantaneously instead of over decades or centuries, a few, right? We're worried about getting above 1.5 C change or 2 C. Well, what about 30 C instead of over decades in a month, right? So huge changes, just inconceivable. Never, ever happened in the paleoclimate record. There has never been changes, except for when you start thinking about asteroid impacts that like wiped out the dinosaurs, right? I mean, there's huge amounts of energy dumped into this system. And I'm just gonna skip this part. This is the part that a lot of my research is, this EMP, looking at satellite technology. But even a limited exchange, you knock out technology and you have a huge climate impact. So that's really the lesson. And this is our research here, looking at large electric fields propagating through the atmosphere like lightning, but much larger scale that can have big impacts. Have any of you had power outage due to a lightning strike?
Yeah.
So, you know, and we, in most of the world, we expect lightning to hit things. And so we develop surge protectors and all types of things. These would just blow right through all of the normal protections. So what can you do? ICANN, International Campaign of Biological Weapons, won the Nobel Peace Prize, so thank you, Norway, 2017. So recognize their work in raising awareness that nuclear weapons are not banned. And part of their effort is to think locally. So Bergen commune or city council should pass a resolution that says the world should ban nuclear weapons. Right? And enough of Norway, maybe even not all of Norway could do it. Ireland and a few other countries have done it as a country. The other organization.
We had this ICANN citizens appeal.
Okay, awesome.
In Belgium.
Oh, great. So yes. Maybe you've already done. I haven't looked at all the cities. It's a big, big list. Union of Concerned Scientists is what I've been a member of for the longest, and they have a lot of information, not only about climate change, but also about nuclear weapons. So if you want to get information about not only what you can do, but learn more about nuclear weapons. So we're 2 minutes to midnight. And part of it is the political, we have Orbán's and Erdogan's and Trump's and Johnson's and Le Pen's of the world that are trying to break apart international agreements. And the whole reason for the United Nations was recognizing that we go to war. We have tribal, all types of things for, and once we've recognized that the next time we go to world war, it could be Stone Age 2.0 or the end of human civilization, we should never have wars again, right? Or we should never, ever even think about, in a war planning game, how to use nuclear weapons. But many people have forgotten the lessons of the Cold War. So unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not Dr. Seuss, the Lorax. So I urge all of you, which you are already doing in the anti-war movement, to let your neighbors and family know that mutually assured destruction is not a sane foreign policy, and that a few countries, primarily the Russia and the United States, but it doesn't take 50 megatons, even tens of kilotons between Pakistan and India. A Hiroshima-sized bomb on Islamabad and New Delhi, the estimate's about 300 million dead, excluding those immediately killed in India and Pakistan. Those are people because of a year without a summer. And it's probably not gonna be us in the US and Norway. We're wealthy and we're able to import foods, but there's a huge amount of people who depend on their annual agriculture, Ethiopia. And just imagine suddenly, where are they gonna go? So if you're worried about refugees now with climate change, even a limited nuclear exchange can change the geopolitics completely. So thank you. Thank you.
us, it's a moderate assessment, right? If I get you right, all the models are for moderate assessments of what is going to happen.
Yep. So people have run very limited exchanges, just India, Pakistan, and some. What would happen if Russia and the U.S. just unleashed 4,000 nuclear weapons at each other? And the curve here essentially gives some of that range. So it's hard to see here, but you can have a very limited range and go down a degree or so, go down 4.5 degrees, or go down over 10 degrees, depending on the size.
So the down to minus 10, that's kind of everything.
That's a U.S.-Soviet Union exchange.
Yes.
A total
and globally temperature change.
Yes.
So that's not moderate.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And, and these are this is a global average, right? And
yes,
so these.
No. I used the word moderate because it was insufficient, as in as insufficient, right?
Yeah.
So it could be. My point was that it would probably and will probably be much worse than you said.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the. Is it around 25% of all the nuclear weapons that we have in the world today? And you're talking about 4,000 weapons.
So the estimate now is we have about 5,000 total worldwide. Adding up, China has a few.
Yeah.
Very small. It's almost all US and Russia. So the French and everybody else have handfuls, where the US and Russia have thousands. And the worst case was if you essentially launched all of the US and Russians.
Okay, yeah. Because I think we have around 16,000 weapons today, atomic warheads today, is that right?
So yeah, so it depends. So what's really weird about an atomic bomb is that a Polaris submarine, which is a, so the U.S. has a triad of nuclear defense, air, sea, and land-based. And the sea-based are submarines. And so the idea was, I can have a submarine off the coast of your country, and you wouldn't even know it. And so I can launch, and you have no time to respond, right? So we just, and a Polaris missile had, I think it has 12 silos. So it can launch 12 missiles. Many of them are long range, you know, 5,000-10,000 kilometers. So, I mean, I could be on the other side of the ocean. And each one of the Polaris missiles can hold 10 warheads. Right? And so they go out into space, they come down, they have a whole bunch of dummy warheads. So if you try to shoot them down, good luck finding the real one. And each one are independently targetable. And so as they come in, people have developed very clever ways of making sure the bomb actually goes where it's supposed to go. So when you talk about, are you talking about the ICBM, the single capsule on top, or each individual?
Mm-hmm.
And so the numbers are crazy on how you divide them. And now that we have withdrawn from our intermediate nuclear force treaty with Russia, there are options for much smaller kiloton size nuclear weapons, and those you can mass produce because you don't need as much material. And so you can. So often people just talk in 5,000 megatons instead of individual warheads because it becomes crazy. And if you look at the arms reduction treaties, often they interchange. So 150 megaton is equivalent to 10.5 megaton is equivalent to. And so it could be in yield or numbers.
How about that?
I was wondering what the impact of nuclear testing has been. And is it because it's underground, it does not have this effect?
And so The last above ground tests were by the French in the 70s. The
Pacific Ocean?
In the ocean, yeah. But the last big American test was in the 60s, 1963, and I'm not going to even try it. It was a high altitude nuclear detonation, and it caused power outages in Honolulu, which was 1,400 kilometers away, and it wiped out over a third of the operational satellites. And so that's when the Soviet Union and the US sat down and said, let's not do this. And so then they moved it to the ground. And then we started getting the understanding the impacts of the radiation fallout, the fissionable materials. And so even here, any of you garden? Dig into the dirt?
Yeah.
Even here, if you want to bring a sample of dirt only a few centimeters below the surface, there's a layer of fission isotopes, cesium, from the 1960s test, right? It got distributed to have a half-life, you know, 100 years. And so we're going to have that layer. And so you can use it to date, you know, when the dirt was laid down.
We still have fallout from Chernobyl.
And Chernobyl, too, as it came up. So, yes, testing is bad, is just in itself. And so Bill Clinton, at the time, signed a test ban treaty that said not only are we going to ban surface tests, but also underground tests. And that gave rise to a huge number of supercomputers. And so now almost all nuclear testing now is done in computer simulations.
I have a question about hydrogen bombs.
Uh-huh.
How much are there of those? And
so
who have most of them? It's, sometimes it's forgotten when we talk about atomic or nuclear
almost all the almost all of the modern nuclear weapons are hydrogen bombs. So we've gone over to hundreds of kiloton to megaton yields because bombs are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and now they're getting smaller and smaller again, but the yields have maintained. And so they use, traditionally they use tritium pits, which is a deuterium and tritium. And that's the thing, that tritium has a half-life of 12 years. So if I just let this sit around, half of my detonator pit decayed away. So I need to replace it constantly. And so that curve of the number of nuclear weapons from 70,000 to 35,000 down to 17,000, that was essentially the half-life of tritium. Unfortunately, fortunately, in the last few years, they've developed an alternative to tritium, essentially able to make a catalytic reaction that creates tritium in the explosion. And so they now have a longer shelf life. And there's a study more recently that puts modern fusion bombs at about 80 years, so they can sit around for a human life.
When you said the U.S. and the then Soviet Union reduced their arsenals, how did they dispose of all those weapons? How does one do that?
So part of it is they didn't get rid of the bomb. They just no longer work anymore. And so there's a lot of parts, the detonator, the switches, and all the fail-safes and all that stuff. And so they stopped modernizing it. And so Obama's new modern nuclear is essentially to upgrade all of the bombs and keep them working, because you would hate to launch a nuclear bomb and it not work. but
really?
But they, for some of them, they actually did destroy. They essentially pulled out the material and separated it, and there are storage sites. And that's the Non-Proliferation and International Security Division within the U.S.'s Department of Energy, which is in the NNSA, the National Nuclear security agency, they're very worried, particularly in the former Soviet Union. There were a lot of weapons scientists in a lot of places where these things were dismantled that are just being stored.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody who wanted to break in or somebody who wanted to make a little money couldn't sell a bunch of plutonium or uranium or tritium on the black market and to Pakistan or whoever. The other concern for nuclear weapons is not the even the use of nuclear weapons, just the material itself. They often call it, instead of a weapon of mass destruction, a weapon of mass disruption. If I took a whole bunch of radioactive material and I just had a regular pressure cooker bomb in Paris, I didn't make an atomic bomb or a nuclear bomb, I just spread the material around Paris. People are not going to go to work, never going to visit Paris again if there's a radioactive background. And so if I put it in the water supply of whoever, right? I mean, so the weapons of mass disruption doesn't actually need a detonation. We have a huge fear of radiation. So it's well-founded in large doses, but even small amounts can panic a lot of people.
Today, our peace-loving social democratic NATO General Secretary announced that NATO is planning to increase its area of operations to include outer space.
Mm-hmm.
Would this intention include things like EMP weapons and that? Or
sure. And President Trump pushed through, and it was just approved less than 3 months ago. The U.S. has a new branch of the military. So we have the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marines, and now the Space Force. And part of it is who controls space has essentially a huge superiority in communication, surveillance, and navigation capability. And so there's anti-satellite missile technology, and those are banned. But 10 years ago, China tested one, blew up one of their old Chinese satellites. Less than a month later, the US launched one to say, we better not do anything because we can do it too. And so there's, even though it's a UN, the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs, based in Vienna, is the UN organization that essentially has all of the international treaties on the peaceful, useful uses of space. But the Russia and the US essentially have been avoiding. So yes, EMP weapons are a major part. The difficulty is that you it can have global effects. So the computer code that I showed you for Bergen is a open source code, and it's to raise awareness. What would happen if a bomb landed on my city? Make it really personal, right? You know, oh man, grandma dies. And but you can play around with it and take a look at the EMP effect and what altitude would be the best place to minimize disruption. So, and Ronald Reagan green-lighted neutron bombs and cruise missiles, so intermediate range missiles with a bomb that had much less fallout. It essentially created neutrons, so it killed people but not wipe out buildings. So there are some interesting researchers going on.
An excellent presentation, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. It's frightening.
Yeah.
And one thing that frightens me especially is if you look at history, weapons from the early days up to today have been produced, developed, to be used. All historic we know about history shows that weapons are produced to be used at some point. And now the thing is, we've been saying, they're not going to use these atomic weapons. Not going to use us. They're not that crazy. They're not that crazy. Nobody's going to do that. Nobody's going to press that button. why not?
So two questions for you. How many of you think nuclear weapons will be used in your lifetime?
Yeah,
and most of us have, it's not going to happen. It hasn't happened. My whole entire life, you know.
The scary thing is the tactical use of these,
yeah,
which is considered.
But the other thing is, how many people on Earth do you think have the capability of starting a nuclear exchange?
More and more.
Well, and you think about, it's not only President Trump, but it's the graduate of University of Bergen who worked for NATO, who developed the fail-safe code to look at early warning systems, and he made a bug in his code. And there is a new radar blip that now somebody has to make a decision. Yeah, right? So a huge range of people, and they could be 18-year-old sailors from any country that can start the cascade.
That was actually happened to Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
There was a warning of nuclear weapon attacking Hawaii, and it was not stopped.
Yeah.
You know? And people had like 20 minutes to react or 10 minutes to react. And it was a false warning.
There was just one, in Norway was involved, a NASA rocket.
Oh, yeah,
out of
yeah, that was, but this Hawaiian thing was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What's intriguing me is when you have all these weapons, they are very, very valuable. They cost lots and lots of money.
Right.
If you're not using them, if you destroy them, they're worth nothing. And all this money, it's used for weapons. It's not used for other things. It's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting aspects of almost all military hardware. They're completely inflationary, right? I mean, a tank does not provide value to anything, right? And it gets blown up, and just buy another one, right? Or a bomb, it blows. So it's just one of the worst economic calculators if you're an economist on how to get, unless you own the company that makes the
exactly.
They basically just answered my question. So.
Okay.
I
was thinking, I mean, if the bomb goes up, you say that the electricity would be gone, but probably not all over the planet. So then I was thinking with this geoengineering, is that kind of, I never understood the concept of that, but it's that something that they will try and use then to rise the temperature again? Is this a tactic that they are using in this regard, or?
Sure, if we have a runaway greenhouse effect, then global temperatures go up and we're gonna melt up. How do we cool temperatures down? Let's have an artificial volcano.
Yeah.
We just put aerosols. Why don't we detonate a bomb and distribute air, right? So there's all different geoengineering, all of them put iron in the ocean to seed algae that will grab carbon that would then, right? There's all different, but you don't know, it's a coupled system. You don't, what's that gonna do to the fish?
Yeah, exactly,
what's that
exactly.
Do?
I mean, it's,
so.
But
playing
do you
God.
Know how much they use these things?
So there is geoengineering ongoing at small scales in terms of cloud seeding and such. It's a big research question right now. And unfortunately, as the climate community has gone through the different stages of grief, and we're now at acceptance, it's going to happen. There's nothing we can do. And so we need to think about how to adapt to this changing climate, and geoengineering is one way to slow it down.
Does everybody know what that is?
So geoengineering is essentially, we're doing an experiment with our atmosphere now. We're putting CO2 in it. Yes. Is there a way that we can globally reduce the CO2? Or one idea is to build thousands of satellites in between the Earth and the Sun that have sunshades to reduce the amount of sunlight.
There's many models. Many
yeah, so there's all different types of ideas. Reduce weathering in the Himalayas by essentially all types of, but it requires a huge amount of mass and energy to do anything. So atomic weapons are one of, you know, well, they're not useful. Maybe we should save the day. But most climate scientists that are looking at geoengineering are not considering nuclear weapons because of the other consequences that would be detrimental. It would cool the Earth, right? I mean,
I have a question. What is the nuclear treaty which Trump and the US pulled out?
Uh-huh.
How is the situation now? It's not so long ago, but it still is some space in time since the pullout. How is the any sign of new production of weapons or renewals of the old ones?
Yeah,
I mean on both sides. I guess as I've learned from before, the United States have I don't know if it's correct now, but more or less half, or as the Russians have,
mm-hmm.
one third, or
yeah.
Russians, or yeah. And how is the situation right now? With, any sign of new ones, or just fixing the stockpiles now on both sides?
So they're doing three things. The Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty essentially was preventing intermediate range tactical nuclear weapons. And so I mentioned that the Russians just launched a submarine-based missile for the first time, because
yeah, 3 weeks ago?
A couple of weeks ago, yeah. And so they're testing new delivery systems. And there's also effort not only to modernize the existing, but also start developing these tactical. But there's mixed messages in terms of a lot of the war games are to protect Europe from a Russian advance. And so placing these tactical nuclear weapons in NATO countries. And so one of the things most of the world realized is that we had nuclear weapons based in Turkey. And so as soon as they joined NATO, they essentially got nuclear weapons. So there's continued development and modernization and use. The defense minister of Turkey, they bought these new surface-to-air missiles from Russia. And there was pictures of them loading them onto Turkish airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And the defense minister says, we bought them to use them.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Do you think the nuclear submarines that are going up the coasts in Norway, there are many, I think it's from 45 to 50 nuclear submarines coming into the coast, Norwegian coast over here the last years. And do you think they're carrying atomic bombs?
They are.
They are.
Yeah.
You said they are.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, our authorities say they are not.
That's right. Yeah, so it, one of the yeah. So I'm saying that they
maybe it's not put together.
Yes. Most nuclear capable submarines are nuclear capable.
Yeah.
You don't tell anyone that they're carrying anything, but
what's the purpose if they're not carrying anything?
Yeah, and that's part of the math, right? Is that you have 18-year-old sailors spending 6 months underwater and you trust them with clothes.
I just wanted to add to that, because it's a policy that is, they call NATO confirm nor deny,
mm-hmm.
that they have used all the time with NATO vessels in our coastal waters, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If our authorities in Norway wants to know, are you carrying nuclear weapons? They will say, NATO confirm nor deny. That's the policy that's always been during Cold War, and still I think it's the same now.
Yeah.
I don't think
it's
changed.
It is the same.
Yeah.
Do you say they are lying?
No, they're not lying.
Well,
they
are
not
lying.
They can neither confirm nor deny.
No, or not
deny
the
proof.
They're lying.
Yeah, there's a whole range of intelligence and security concerns, and nuclear weapons are sort of the top level secrets of every country. And almost anything to do with them are classified. But what's weird about the classification schemes are this information is not classified, and this information is not classified. But if I put the information together, then they are classified. And so there's some weird tiptoeing that a lot of people have to do.
Do you know how many missiles the Israeli has?
I don't know. And so there are a number of countries that are thought to be nuclear armed. Israel is one of them, but they neither confirm nor deny that they are a nuclear weapon state.
Mm. Yeah, but there has been some research on it, hasn't it?
Yep. And so there are a lot of Israeli nuclear physicists that have the know-how and technology, and that's one of the big issues right now is in Saudi Arabia. Not only are they selling their national oil with the biggest IPO of stock, they're also are developing capabilities for their own nuclear power. And the same technology that can develop energy with nuclear power can produce fissionable material for bombs. And so that's one of the reasons, like Iran, we don't want even to have them have a reactor because there's intimate relationships. And so that's part of this non-proliferation is, where do you draw the line? You know, you should be able to have a power plant if you want it, but you can produce fissionable material to create a nuclear weapon from it too.
But we have choose to talk only about Iran in the West, not Saudi Arabia as a possibility. So just
and not Israel.
Yeah. As always, we choose sides.
That's right. Yes. So
I mean, you stick to them.
Yep. So
yes,
very dangerous. That's one of the issues in the U.S. politics too, is that the Trump administration, the first country he visited was Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's even a lot of controversy on waiving technology transfer for both Saudis and UAE. Yeah. So there's a large number of countries in the world that have the technical know-how to develop nuclear weapons.
Great. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Isn't that so good?
Figure this thing out.
It looked very good with that. No.